Well, thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And if you're just listening for the first time, please know that this show is on the air for you. And we do it by bringing special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain. Now, our goal for each show is to bring answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network and browse through a variety of heartfelt and enlightening topics. I am confident that something that you will find will bring greater joy to your life. Now, I also have a favor to ask. Please forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is just one powerful way that we can make a positive difference in the world together. Now, our topic today is also the title of our guest's new book, Cowboy Up, Humor, Life Lessons, and Timeless Truths. And Alan Day's upbringing branded him as a cowboy from the day he was born, or at least that's what I've been told. To this day, he claims that he has soil running through his veins. Now, he was part of the third generation to grow up on a 2,000 acre. Get that again. 2,000. 200,000. I'm sorry. 200,000 acre. Yeah, I was getting so excited over it. I missed a couple of zeros. But anyway, it was the Lazy Bee Cattle Ranch, and it straddled the high deserts of southern Arizona and northern Mexico.
But New Mexico.
Yeah,
see
that? Yeah, and New Mexico. And that's the thing. I mean, 200,000 acres. It's just amazing to me, and especially in this day and age to where, you know, we're buying a home, and I'm excited because it's a third of an acre.
I often wonder what went through my granddad's mind when he selected that dry, sparse 200,000 acres. Was it the fact that nobody else wanted it, or nobody else would go there? Or I often wondered what went through his mind when he said, okay, this is going to be our ranch.
Well, or just maybe he was just way ahead of his time, and he knew that as people expanded out, that there was going to be a need, and he was going to be there to provide it. So, yeah, let me share a little bit more in regards to Alan, because he graduated from the University of Arizona, and he returned to manage the Lazy Bee Ranch for 40 years. And during that career, he received numerous awards for his dedication and stewardship of the land, something that I think is great. In 1989, he purchased a cattle ranch in Nebraska and soon after a ranch in southern Dakota. The latter became the first government-sponsored sanctuary for 1,500 unadoptable wild horses. And I want to talk a little more about that a little later. Alan and his sister, Sandra Day O'Connor. Yes, for those of you thinking about that, yes, it's that Sandra Day O'Connor. Co-authored Lazy Bee, about growing up on the family ranch. Alan then went on to write The Horse Lover, about adventures managing and training those 1,500 wild Mustangs. And now Cowboy Up, about life lessons learned on the Lazy Bee Ranch. He is also the co-host of the Cowboy Up podcast, which airs on Apple and Spotify. And just to let you know, folks, I've checked that out. And I've really enjoyed it. So, Alan, welcome to Answers Network.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is fun to sit here, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you know, one of the things about this show is that we're always looking for people that are making a positive difference in the world. And there's lots of ways in which we can do this. And there are people that do it because they're doing something in medicine, or they're doing something in some other form. But I think that some of the things that you've done in regards to, and I said earlier when we were off the air talking about, how we take care of our land. You mentioned that, you coined the phrase happy grass. One of the people I follow is Dr. Mark Hyman, and he talks a lot about how important that is for our continued growth, as a race. you know, to be able to know how to take care of our land, because if we don't take care of it, sooner or later, we're going to run into some problems with our own health. So I want you to know, I really appreciate you being here and all the things that you're doing.
Well, as we said, I'm happy to be here. And so any way I can shed light on anything, I'm happy to. I would respond and say that trying to think of something to do better for, you know, for the world, for where we live. Mm-hmm. I thrashed around for a lot of years and would go down this road a while and down that road a while. And finally, after many years and many failures and many adventures, finally decided the thing that was the most important in my professional life was grass.
And for those of you listening, this isn't the kind you smoke.
Yeah, that's a different world.
Exactly. But, you know, as I mentioned in the intro about growing up on a 200,000 acre cattle ranch, share with us a little bit about what that was like and how that influenced you growing up.
Well, I don't know how you couldn't be totally immersed in that, because the ranch was all in contiguous. It was all in one block, and it was kind of a big valley with mountains on the west, mountains on the south, the Gila River on the north, and a big playa flat on the east side. But you'd stand in the middle of the ranch, and when you'd look any direction, you couldn't see anything else but the ranch. You know, it was everything that you could see was part of Lazy Bee. And I didn't think that was unusual. I mean, that's how I was raised. That when mm-hmm. you're raised up with something like that, that's just life as you know it. But I would have people come out to the ranch, and the one that really stood out one time was a couple of Japanese journalists came out to the ranch, mm-hmm. and they had been interviewing my big sister, Sandra, about her influence in the world and what all, and they wanted to see where she was raised. And so they said, mm-hmm. they were going to travel all the way from D.C. To Lordsburg to mm-hmm. See where Sandra was raised. And they said, well, we only want to use a half hour of your time. We'll be there a half an hour. And I said, no, you know, you can't get a sense of what it is and where it is in a half an hour. You know, you can't, I can't, nobody can. Mm-hmm. So you've got to agree to spend a day with me. And then sure. we can traipse out around, not necessarily the edges of the ranch, but traipse out on the ranch any direction. And after a day, you will have a real sense of, you know, what it's like to try to define 200,000 acres. And so they got there. And I drove them around and talked to them quite a little. And mm-hmm. both of them told me each one of them had been raised in Tokyo in 500 square feet. That was their house.
Wow.
And so they said, well, we're standing here in the middle of this, and it's all around us, and we can't comprehend it. We can't swallow it. It, mm-hmm. it just doesn't compute for us. And, you know, we know what you're showing us. We know where we're standing. But we can't bend our mind to accept that. And they weren't saying I was lying, but they were just saying it was too big a concept to get their arms around.
Well, yeah. In fact, as you know, having been to Tokyo, I'm thinking that, you know, they came from a place where there was 20 million people living on a piece of property smaller than they were now looking at.
Well, I hadn't thought of it in that light, but you're probably right.
20 million people. Yeah. Wow.
That would trample down a bunch of grass, wouldn't it?
Yes.
With those 20 million people out there.
So talk about some of your influences. I know in some of your writings, you talk about some of the other cowboys that were there that sort of mentored you. And I've got to imagine that with that much space and stuff, I mean, this isn't something to where only your parents can be involved in your life. I would think there was a lot. And I know you mentioned four cowboys in particular that worked on the ranch each for over 50 years. And you added that they become like an extended family. Talk about what you learned from them in regards to patience, persistence, and just living a good and healthy life.
Well, the four men that I were our longtime cowboys were just extended family. You know, we mm-hmm. ate Thanksgiving dinner together and, you know, shared all kinds of things. They taught me how to drive a pickup and, you know, that I don't know that they taught me how to ride, because you put a kid on a horse, they then know how to ride. But anyway, we just all shared our lives together, and they were all four really different. And so Claude Tibbetts was one that I was really close to. And Claude was the hardest worker of any person I've ever known. And my dad never told him what to do or outlined work. Claude just mm-hmm. saw projects that needed doing, and then he would just go out and do them. It didn't matter if they took a day or a week or a month and or even longer. And so when I was growing up, I worked with him quite a little. And so working really hard on a spillway on a big water pond one time, and hauling rocks and putting in the spillway. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, is there a way we could do this faster? And Claude said, well, Alan, probably there is. But he said, when we finish this job, there's another one. And when we finish that, there's another one behind that. And the list goes on. So we're not going to run out of things to do. So let's just do the best that we can do, because it's not like we're going to finish this and take a vacation. It's like the work, the projects were all different, but there was a list too long to even list that needed doing. And so from Claude, I learned persistence and patience and, you know, do the best you can. One thing he always said is, when we put in a fence, he always said, let's really use good posts and good wire, because he said, I want this to still be here when I'm dead and gone. So I want to build it in a way that it will outlive me. And I just always thought, wow, that's a pretty good philosophy to have, is to build projects that will live longer than you will.
So yeah, that's a great way to look at it. As you were saying that, it reminded me, just it's in regards to my dad at times, one of his sayings was, when I wanted to do something quick, and the reason usually was because I had something else I wanted to do, you know, as a child, I mean, I wanted to do something else. And he'd say, you know, I'd say, you know, can't we get this done faster? He says, well, we probably could, but then you're probably going to be coming back and doing it over again.
All true. Yeah.
So I learned the same thing. I guess I better do it right the first time.
Another one of our cowboys that I always admired, and, you know, I like to say he's the best cowboy I ever met in my life. And I guess that still is true. But Jim Brister was this wonderful horseman, cowboy. Anything you could do with your feet hanging down off a horse, he could do it, and do it better than anybody I ever knew. And but he didn't like to get off the horse and do work on the ground. You'd go to branding and what all, he'd do it, but he wanted to be on the horse just as quick as he could. And so he showed me so many things about being one with the horse and being able to just mm-hmm. think what you want to do and have the horse read your mind and working together with the horses. And so he was an amazing person to watch, and how he and his horse together made this incredible team. So that was another one of the four.
Mm-hmm. And now you just mentioned about being one with the horse. And I know that in some of the podcasts that I've listened to of yours, and in reading some of your work, it took me to the thought of what we call equine therapy. And although you may not know, but I visited many boarding schools and wilderness programs that are designed for at-risk youth. And many of these programs are set up, and they use equine therapy to work with many of the kids. What are some of the lessons that you learned from horses, and how might some of those, you know, how do you see those fitting with other people maybe that have not had that opportunity?
That's a hard one, because I think each of us individually relate to the horse in a different way. And it might even be the same horse, but with different riders. And each one of those riders is going to pick something from the horse that they learn. And it might be something different than the next guy that gets on. So it's a little difficult to picture that. But I could give you one quick story of a horse that I may be the best horse I ever rode, named Sure. Saber. And I owned his mother, the dam, and the stallion, and then raised him as a colt. And he was just this, the prettiest colt we ever raised was Saber. And he was white. He had black mane and tail, but Saber was white. We didn't have any white horses on the ranch, but he was. And anyway, I chose him as my horse and then broke him and rode him. And so one particular incident, he could walk the fastest of any horse on the ranch. He could walk faster than the other horses. He also could run faster than the other horses. Mm. He also was smarter than the other horses. I mean, just anything you wanted to name, he was the best. And so one day he could really run, and I had never turned him completely loose to run. I always held back a little bit, you know, because him at 3/4 speed was plenty fast to do anything you needed to do. So I had never just turned him loose. And one day, for some reason, I thought, I've never turned him totally loose. I'm going to do it today, and I'm going to see how he can run, you know, just fully, fully wide open. So, and wasn't in front of anybody or trying to prove anything to anybody else. It was just me sitting on this horse and respecting him, but saying, you know, I haven't experienced that with him. So all the other cowboys were having lunch, and I saddled up and went down all by myself and picked out a cow. We'd gathered a bunch of cattle that day, and I picked out a big old long-legged cow that I thought could run pretty fast. And I just charged her with Saber, and she went running up the fence. And so when she got really running, then I turned him out to go around her and turn her back against the fence. And so we went flying past her. You know, he was just on fire. He was flying, and she turned back all of a sudden, and so did he. And but she was against the fence. I was running parallel to the fence. And when he turned back, he leaned down like a water skier. You see the water skier with their shoulder almost touching the water, making a turn and all the spray coming up. Well, he made a turn like that, and he leaned way down to make the turn before we got to the fence. And the ground was pretty soft there. And so we were leaned so far down that the ground just gave way with his hooves, with his feet. And we just went sliding because he lost traction. And so we slid under the fence. And so I'm still sitting in the seat of the saddle, and I have a leg under him and a leg on top, and we're flat on the ground and slid under that barbed wire fence. And the wire came clear up to his shoulders and up to his hips. You know, then his legs were on one side, and the big part of his body and me were on the other side, and he was under the fence. So I took stock of what I had right there real quick, and I could see that if he went to struggling, that he was really going to get cut badly by that barbed wire, you know, because he was clear under the fence. And if he was trying to struggle and get up, he'd end up with big cuts all on his lower legs and wherever he was struggling. And so I just real quietly spoke to him, and I said, Saber, this was my fault. I shouldn't have done this. I put you in this place to, and now you could get hurt. I don't want you to move. We'll get help. Help will arrive, but don't you move. And I put my hand up. I'm laying flat on the ground, leg underneath him, put my hand up on his shoulder and just talked to him, and had to wait maybe 5 minutes for somebody to show up and help us. And Saber never moved one muscle in that 5 minutes. He laid there exactly listening to me and doing what I asked him to do. And I thought later, how many horses would do that? I mean, a traumatic event like that, you'd want to struggle and get up and you know, what all. And he laid there, and then one of the cowboys came up and tossed the loop of the rope down and drug us out from under the fence, you know, without, and Saber didn't have a mark on him. But that was a case of us communicating totally, and Saber just exactly responding.
Yeah, and the feeling I was getting was trust. Yeah, that you know, you had earned enough trust in that trust bank account for Saber to just go, okay, I'm just gonna do, and could somehow sense, you know, the sincerity in what you were trying to say. I think that's great.
And I'm not sure you learn that. You have to learn it, because if you didn't learn it, you wouldn't know it. But just being with a horse builds that kind of feeling in you and in the horse. And so, but I didn't do any exercises or anything in preparation for that. It was just us communicating.
Yeah. Again, I mentioned that I'd gone out to some of these places, and what I found in listening to them talk about why the horses were responding to certain kids and not to others. And they gave an example that there was a young man out there that had been a gang member, and he was somebody who had exploited people. And so he essentially was a predator, and the horses there would not give him the time of day. They would not let him on them. They would not, he would go up to pet them. They would move away from him. And what the person who was doing the training in this situation said, how perceptive the horses were, in the sense that this person is a predator. They cannot trust this person. And yet there were other kids who had been victims of predators, and the horses were right there for them, and, you know, let them pet them and eventually let them get on them, and felt like they could trust them more than they could some of these young men who had been predators in the city of other people. So I thought that was very interesting, that, and essentially what they were saying is with horses being prey animals, that they were very, very sensitive to the differences. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm sure that's true. I've never had that exact experience, you know, around me, but knowing horses, I'm sure that's exactly true. Okay. So we all could learn more than we think we could from horses. And I don't think you got to ride along every day trying to think, what can I learn from this horse? It just comes with the territory.
So I have a question that is coming in right this moment. And it says, a friend of mine that I spoke to last weekend is a botanist for the Forest Service. She said that they have staff out spraying weeds. I can't read that word. I think it's a misspelling, but anyway, they're spraying weeds with Roundup. She believes that this is the protocol throughout the entire national forest. It says, of course, Roundup has glyphosate, which is in it. What are your thoughts on that and how that's affecting our soil?
Well, I'm pretty sure that what she's asking is in Roundup has the same molecular stuff as what the servicemen called Agent Orange. Ooh. That they got sprayed with, you know, in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And they were spraying the jungle to kill the jungle and sprayed the people. And then the people, it affected them in a whole lot of ways.
That's true.
So I'm almost certain that we're talking about the same product there. And I can tell you, I've been drenched in Roundup to where it was as much as if I'd taken a shower in Roundup. But I was always the one. My dad would get a big old tank and a trailer, put it on behind the Jeep, and then a 100-foot hose behind that. And then guess who got to walk along with the hose and spray all the cuckleburrs and the bad weeds? That was me. And so I did that day after day. And the wind blows. And so when you're downwind, it'll carry the spray away from you. When you're upwind, it'll blow it right back in your face and just coat you with it. And we didn't know how bad that chemical was when I was a kid and doing that. We didn't know how bad that was. It was just something that was unpleasant to do, and we did it. And why I'm still able to talk to you and not be gibberish, I don't know, because I've had huge doses.
But I believe with what we were talking about earlier before we went on the air, so you've since changed some of that. So tell us a little bit about now what you're doing in regards to, I think you called it happy grass.
Well, over a lot of years, you things become important to you in ranching. And, you know, to give you some examples, some ranchers are so proud of their horses that they're ranching to them is riding the best horse in the county. And other ranchers are, you know, proud of the breeding in their cattle and their horses, and they have the best Hereford cattle in the county or the best Angus or whatever. And slowly over the years, I finally decided that the most important thing to be a good rancher is to try to understand what's in that surrounds you, you know, what the environment that you're working in is, what makes it healthy, what makes it not healthy, and to try to understand more of that. And so I coined a term, and maybe a lot of other people use it, but the term I like is happy grass. And, you know, how can I be a rancher and make a living doing it and have happy grass? And so that has a lot of connotations because it takes a lot of things to make happy grass. For example, if you get enough rain, if you get enough sunshine, if you get enough conditions to grow well, the grass will grow well, but it might not rain and it might be dry and grass not grazed. You may graze it too heavily and do damage to the grass. It may get flooded and just washed away. And so there are all kinds of things that can make good or make bad with your surroundings. And so I determined that I should be more aware all the time of everything around me as much as I could. And why is the grass happy? Why is the grass not happy? What's it going to take to make happy grass? Is it a case of rainfall? But no, might it be the case of having too many hooves walk over it or you know, all kinds of other things. And be too hot, be too wet, be too cold to make happy grass. So what's it going to take? And can I affect any of those things? You know, on the positive side, can I make some of those things happen to make the environment where cows will like it, but where the environment will be happy?
Right, exactly. And we need that environment to keep existing for all of us. And we're talking with Alan Day. And we're talking about his new book, Cowboy Up, Humor, Life Lessons, and Timeless Truths. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585 or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
All right, we're back. You are listening to Answers Network, and we have cowboyed up. We're talking with Alan Day, and we're talking about a lot of things. Part of it has to do with growing up on a 200,000-acre ranch. Alan, wanted to talk about just what do you think some of the lessons that children raised in the city could benefit from either working with horses or spending quality time on a working ranch?
Well, that's a pretty broad statement and a pretty broad question. But I just think every day when you go out on the ranch when you're a kid, you go out with the adults, with the ranch hands, with the manager, whatever. And you just share in what they're doing. I mean, today mm-hmm. might be working on a windmill, and tomorrow might be rounding up and moving some cattle, and the next day might be working on a road. And so the children go along and share in just whatever is going on the ranch. And so it's not one thing they learn, but they learn every day. You know, don't hit your finger with that hammer. Well, maybe they have to hit their finger with a hammer to learn not to. But, you know, those kind of things, I mean, just daily things that you do on the ranch, every one of them can be a lesson. And mm-hmm. so I really believe that kids enjoy being on the ranch. And I know I have two sisters, and each one of them had several children. And the day school was out in the spring, they would arrive at the ranch, and then they wanted to be there all summer. And then the day before school started in the fall, they'd go back home. So I was camp director and Uncle Al to all of the kids all summer, every year. And we all loved it. I loved having the kids there and being Uncle Al, and they loved what they learned on the ranch and how to do it. They all learned to ride. They all learned to drive a car. They all learned to do whatever we do on the ranch. And, sometimes painfully. Mm-hmm. But, what came to my mind just now, one of Sandra's boys was riding probably a horse that he shouldn't have been on one day. And you've heard about getting clotheslined, you know, run under something and
yep.
get off. Well, this was truly a clothesline. His horse ran off with him and ran under a clothesline and hooked him right in the neck.
Ooh.
The horse kept going, and his legs swung up, and down he came. And so part of it was he tore part of an ear off. You know, he kind of got injured with his ear. And so it took him down to the local doctor, and Doc Lovett said, well, glad to see him. He said, every one of the grandkids, I get to see him at least once every summer because something happens to him. But I will always remember Jay with his ear hanging down. Ooh. And the saying, you know, this moment is not fun.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you mentioned your sister Sandra, and I think that most people listening would know that Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female justice sitting on the Supreme Court. Talk a little bit about what it was like, having a famous sister like that. How did that change your life? You mentioned about the Japanese reporters coming out, but what are some other things that maybe you can share with us?
Well, Sandra was always a fast learner and really bright. And she enjoyed what all we did on the ranch and was always good at it. But she learned all kinds of things that maybe didn't help her later on in her legal career, but just helped her as a problem solver on the mm-hmm. ranch. And so I know she always took every opportunity that she could to come back to the ranch later on. And we spent happy hours and happy days there when she was on the court and being one of the most prominent women in the whole world. Well, her background was her background. That was her rock. That's what that had so much to do with the final product that Sandra is.
And we've got some comments that have come in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time to send in comments and questions. This one reads, I grew up in the farmlands of North Carolina. I went on to a career in the city. But when it came time to have children in my 30s, my husband and I decided that it was important that they be raised in a similar way of life as we grew up with. 15 years have passed since we moved to back to a rural country setting, and our two children are such happy, responsible, and caring kids. My comment is that living in this way instills qualities that I believe get sometimes lost in city life. Also, I'm a huge fan of your sister. I am really looking forward to hearing more about what she was like and how the two of you became such successful, amazing people. And this is from Valerie in Virginia.
Well, most of what she said there, I'd say she should be on the broadcast, not me, because those that was awfully good comments that that lady wrote. But, you know, it was Sandra growing up with Sandra. We had, you know, adventures together that both of us shared and both of us enjoyed. And I'm sure became better people because of that. So Sandra was not the best horsewoman that ever lived. You know, her brain was somewhere else, and she wasn't bad on horseback, but you know, some people just look like they were born on the horse. She wasn't one of those, but anyway, we had a lot of good times together. But probably when Sandra and I got the closest is she called me one day. She was already on the Supreme Court, and she said, Alan, you and I need to write a book together. And, you know, my writing up to that point was signing checks, not much more. And so I said, well, why do you want to write a book? And furthermore, why do you want to involve me? And she said, well, that people all over the world had asked her, well, how did somebody from a rural, humble agricultural background achieve what you've achieved in the world? Because coming from that place, it's a giant leap to world, you know, acknowledgement.
Exactly. And
so she said, well, we need to write a book together. And that book will be the broad answer to that question, is how did she achieve what she achieved? And it won't be in one sentence or one paragraph or even in one chapter, but it will be throughout the book, and it will be the broad answer to how did Sandra become what she was. And so I was kind of flabbergasted that she would ask me to help with that project. But she said, well, that I had stayed on the ranch and had all the anecdotes and stories and funny stories about, you know, events that happened on the ranch, and those give vitality to the book. And so she wanted me for those kinds of things. So we sat down and wrote the book together. And while we were writing the book, we laughed and cried and talked and about all kinds of the ranch stories, you know, all what ranching was like. And we became a lot closer by virtue of writing the book together. So that was a gift that I've never forgotten.
Well, I'm one that loves stories, and I know so do many of our listeners. Share with us one of, you know, you were talking about as you were writing with her, some of the funny anecdotal type of things. Share with us one of your favorite stories.
Well, okay. When I was real young, my dad and the cowboys weren't quite as concerned with the grass and the health of the grass as I was. And so they sometimes let the ranch get overgrazed. And so when that would happen, we'd get a lot of thin cattle. You know, the cattle wouldn't get enough nutrient and they'd get thin. And I don't know that any ever starved to death, but some of them got so thin they could just barely walk. I mean, you could grab hold of their hip bone with your hand because the hip bone was sticking out, and you could count their ribs because the ribs were, you know, could show. So anyway, sometimes they would get to where you had to help them get up. They were too weak to get up. And so we would try to rescue those cows and put them on good feed and try to bring them back. But sometimes those cows that we were helping, we called it tail up. You'd get a man on either side of the cow and then the third one in the back to take the tail and wrap it around your neck. And then you'd stand up and lift the cow up to help her get up. Mm-hmm. And so that was doing good for the cow. But sometimes those cows would be angry because they mm-hmm. didn't like being in the condition they were in, and they didn't like what they had, you know, where they were, and they didn't like you being around them. And so I was this little kid, and I, of course, wanted to be where all the action was. So I would go down, and if we had a couple of old cows that we call it tail them up, you know, you'd wrap the tail around your neck and help them stand. And so when we had a cow that needed that, or two or three sometimes, I'd be there spectating. And so one particular time, the cowboys tailed this old cow up, and she was angry. She was angry at being there and angry at the world and just an angry cow. So the cowboys helped her up, and then they slid back behind her to where she didn't want to turn around and fight them. But guess who was up in front of them was little me at about age six. And so she charged me. And I can remember still today how frightening that was to have this big old mean, angry cow trying to do me in and charge me. And she had horns, and I could just visualize her hooking me with a horn, you know, and throwing me to the ground or sticking the horn all the way through me. And so I was running as fast as I can, screaming, no doubt. And I had my hand back behind me, and her forehead was, she was pushing me with, my hand was on her forehead. Mm-hmm. And she was snorting and trying to get me and pushing me, and I was trying to outrun her. And I can remember thinking, wow, I am really scared of this cow. I don't know what she's going to do to me. But that was the most frightening moment I ever had as a young child, is there having that old cow trying to do me in.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I felt the hair coming up on the back of my neck as you were telling me that, thinking about trying to run and not feeling like I had quite enough to get away. Okay. We've got another comment that came in, and this one reads, 5 years ago, our family, which included our two boys, ages 12 and 14, signed up to participate in an 8-day spring cattle drive. The boys were immediately given responsibilities and were mentored by a ranch hand the entire time. They were glued to his every word, and I just loved the confidence he instilled in them. This experience was a pivotal point for our kids, and they came away passionate about nature and the outdoors. Our entire family is looking forward to reading your book and doing another cattle drive. And this is from Henry in Indiana.
Well, congratulations to you, Henry, for having a great time, and being out with the cattle and the cowboys is an adventure that you usually can't even buy. And if you have a chance to participate in that, grab it and hold on to it, because that's one you won't forget.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. Now we've got another question that has come in. This one actually came in from a teacher that says that they're not going to be able to listen. But this one says, there's been a lot of press about beef and the way in which our farmlands are being used. Do you believe that properly raised livestock are key to regenerative farming and our human nutrition?
Big, tough, many-sided question, because you can approach it from a lot of different directions. Is the best thing to leave our prairies untouched and let nature take a, you know, take a hand in it? Or is it better to try to farm some of it? Is it better to graze that and rest it to manage the land? Those are all good questions. I would come down on the side of it's good to put the land to good use if it's good use for the land and for the person who's using it. You know, and sometimes it might be good for the land and not good for the person, meaning you can go bankrupt trying to do something with the land that the land doesn't want to do, and or vice versa. You can be a smart guy but not know how to manage land and do damage to the land by trying to do good things, but maybe the universe says that's not a good thing, that's a bad thing. So it's a hard question to answer because it's really a broad question.
Well, but it sounds like when I was talking with you that that you're doing things that would fall into that category of more regenerative in the sense that that you've been able to for however many years that your family has had this land, you've been able to continue to make it prosper, to continue to be able to grow the grass, to have grass-fed beef, to be able to do all of the things. And I kind of read this as, because I also, you know, I read a lot about these things as it relates to our health, about some of the places that have just abused the land to the point that it can't be used anymore. But it sounds like you're sort of making sure that the land is still useful for many, many generations. And I think that's what a lot of people are trying to see happen. And it sounds like what they're trying to ask about. Does that sound about right?
Well, let me give you an example that we use. It comes up, how do you measure that? How the land doesn't go to hell in 10 minutes and it doesn't resurrect in 10 minutes. How about 10 years? You know, those kind of things. So it's hard to see the changes, just like it is when a kid's growing. If you see him today and see him in a week, you can't see the growth, but yet there's growth there. So land is the same way. So let me give you a little example of one way that we kind of measure the land and see what's happening is we take a 4-foot square piece of metal, a rod, you know, 4 feet square, and we pick a place and we drive a permanent stake in the ground. And then we take photographs and measure, and you measure how much basal area is there with all the grass plants in that 4-foot square area. And then you take photographs of it. And then you do it the next year, and you do it half a year, and then you do it in another half year, and then again and again and again and again. And over a 10-year, maybe 15-year period, you would be amazed at how much changes you're going to see in that land. But you have to take a representative piece. You don't want to take a piece that never gets grazed, and you also don't want to get a piece of land that's 10 feet away from the water trough that gets walked on every single day while the cows are going to water. You take an area that represents an average. You know, and then you're able to measure that small piece of ground, and then you can interpolate from that what's happening in the bigger land around it. And you might have 10 of those square areas around the ranch here and there. And then you take the composite of what's happened on all 10 of those, and you can see a trend. Is it getting better? Is there getting to be more grass? Is the grass more healthy or not? And so those are some. That's not a real easy way to do it, but it's not difficult. I mean, it's easy to visualize that piece of ground's not going anywhere. And so if you have some patience, you can find out over a period of time whether that land is getting better and the grass is getting better or not.
Yeah, but it sounds like, see, that's the thing is that your family's done this for so long, you know how to monitor it in such a way that it continues to produce. So, Alan, the time has just flown by. I can hardly believe it. But for everybody out there, the book is Cowboy Up, humor, life lessons, and timeless truths. And Alan, I assume that they can get the book anywhere books are sold. Anything else you'd like to share?
Oh, I'm just happy to be here today. You know, when you, when I did want to bring up, we hadn't said that, I'm not active on the ranch every day. I got older and I have children, but none of them were interested in coming to the ranch. And that, we could have talked about that for a while, but sad that they aren't out there on the ranch. But I ended up selling the ranch because, you know, you get old enough, you just can't do what you used to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm here to talk about it, but not here to go out and buck hay.
Well, one of my sons just bought one of my companies. And so we're all getting older, and it's nice if we can still share some of our experiences. So, and Alan, I'm so glad that you came on to share yours. And I appreciate it. And again, for everybody out there, check out the Cowboy Up podcast if you want to hear more from Alan. So, Alan, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
All right. And for everybody out there, I want you to know that there are many top healers today that are showing the incredible advantages of natural medicine. So be with us next week when we're going to be joined by the author of The Physics and Poetry of Eastern Medicine. And if you get a chance, please visit our archives of past interviews at Answers Network, or just subscribe to the show through your favorite platform, Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube. See, if you pick YouTube, you get to see us as well as hear us. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.